Welcome to today's program titled Social Media Privacy Legislation Update. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Sarfarth Shah, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. Please feel free to visit the conference materials pod and download any handouts. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Robert Milligan. You may begin.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the audience for joining us this morning. Today's topic is Social Media Privacy Legislation Update, Some Practical Strategies for Employers. I'd like to introduce you briefly to our panel. First, my name is Robert Milligan. I'm a partner in our Los Angeles office of Sarfarth Shah. I'm joined by a fellow partner, Daniel Hart, who's out of our Atlanta, Georgia office, and then an associate, Joshua Salinas, who's also based out of our Los Angeles office. We all have experience with trade secrets. We're all members of our trade secret and social media group. We typically represent clients in workplace investigations, trade secret cases, as well as employment cases involving social media privacy and trade secret type issues. I wanted to give you a brief overview of what we're going to be covering in today's one-hour program. It's important to note that we welcome questions, so feel free to use the multimedia menu to lodge any questions or questions that you may have about today's presentation. We'll try to answer those at the end of the program or follow up with you on an email in response to your question. As far as today's coverage of the material, social media and privacy issues related to social media are very significant and have heard about a lot in the news recently. We want to cover with you the recent social media privacy legislation. Starting approximately in 2012, we saw a large uptick in the number of states that have passed social media privacy legislation designed primarily to protect prospective employees and employees. There's also been some legislation to protect students and potential students. The focus of today's presentation is obviously on the employment aspect. We're going to have a discussion about the risks of social media. Obviously, social media comes up on a daily basis in most workplaces, be it litigation, be it workplace investigations, be it competitive activity. Social media is omnipresent. We're going to talk about the various laws that regulate social media in addition to this privacy legislation, and what you need to know on a practical basis in order to conduct an effective workplace investigation, as well as how to handle it in litigation. Dan's going to cover some of the latest and greatest as it relates to creating an enforceable social media policy. It seems like that particular topic changes on a daily basis based upon the decisions that we're seeing out of the National Labor Relations Board. In fact, there was a recent decision that Dan will cover that highlights an additional tweak to what you need to include in your social media policy. And then finally, I'm going to cover some of the do's and don'ts as it relates to using social media in workplace investigations and how social media comes up in the trade secret arena. sort of the off-the-cuff response is, well, if it's, you know, been put in the public domain, it can't be a trade secret. And so if, to the extent that it's in, you know, social media and a publicly visible account, it can no longer be a trade secret. Well, yes and no, and we're going to talk about some cases that have addressed that particular issue and what companies need to be thinking about, you know, if they are using social media platforms and how they can do a better job of, you know, protecting trade secrets in that space. I think a good rule of thumb is that, well, on a trade secret case per se, information that's stored in a social media platform may not qualify for a trade secret. The underlying social media evidence that you may find as far as updates, posts, connections, links can help you very much in a non-compete restrictive covenant case. So it all's not lost as far as from a trade secret, as far as from a employee mobility restrictive covenant type suit. I want you to think about three hypos based upon real cases that are going to come up in today's discussion to sort of frame our reference. The first hypo is an employee that converses with fellow employees on Facebook about their employer not properly taking out withholdings from their paycheck and then having a hefty bill from the IRS. And whether if an employer were to make a discipline decision based upon what they saw on social media, whether that could run afoul of some of the laws that are out there. Another hypo I want you to think about is imagine a company that writes reviews about the latest and greatest as it relates to mobile phone devices, equipment. And their business is the business of providing content to consumers. And if they have an employee that writes content for them and has a Twitter following and has a Twitter account that references the company and it contains some of the company's various customers, whether that under those particular scenarios, who owns the social media account and whether there can be any protection for the followers that follow that particular employee's Twitter account. And then lastly, I want you to think about a hypo about ongoing litigation in a personal injury employment type matter where the underlying plaintiff posts some information that seemed to indicate that the damages and the personal injury is not so significant. And then later, the attorney and the employee disable the account and try to purge the account of that particular post and what kind of consequences that can run from undertaking such actions. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Joshua Salinas. I hope those three examples we're going to cover in today's presentation. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Joshua Salinas to get into the latest as it relates to this social media privacy legislation, the nuts and bolts, and how it works.
Thanks, Robert. We've seen now how ubiquitous social media has become. You know, the last several years, many companies have embraced it to develop business further, to connect better with clients, to develop successful campaigns. But there have also been some concerns with some unintentional use or where you have employees or individuals in the workplace who are using social media, whether the company sometimes wants them to or not. Just some interesting statistics. We know how big, you know, Facebook and Twitter have become and LinkedIn. With Facebook, we have nearly a billion daily active users that are spending on average about 20 minutes on the website each day. With Twitter, we've seen about 500 million tweets individually each day. LinkedIn has been one of the rapidly growing social media accounts networks with new members about two every single second. Some of the more recent and rapidly rising social media networks, we have Snapchat, which is a new mobile device app that allows users to send messages, to send photos, to send videos that have some of the somewhat of a self-destruct timer built in where the photo or the video is sent and can be viewed by selected individuals or the public for a specific amount of time that the creator sends. We've also seen with Pinterest, which is similar to a message board or an online, a digital board where users can post pictures or images and a wide variety of areas. All of these social media accounts, and like most other social media networks, do have some mobile access, some mobile device app. So while employers may want to restrict access to their employees to these websites, sometimes it does become difficult to see employees are bringing in their own kind of personal devices into the workplace. Now, there's an interesting study that was done a few years ago by both Symantec and Eponymon, and they surveyed about 3,300 individuals in six different countries, and it concerns the use, the access to company confidential information and trade secrets. And what they found is that over half of the employees admitted that they had emailed business documents from their workplace to their personal email account. And actually 41% said that they do those emails at least once a week. 41% said they downloaded intellectual property to their personally owned smartphones or tablets. And about 37% said they used file sharing applications such as Dropbox and Google Docs without company permission. And while this is concerning, because while we previously talked about kind of the widespread use of social media such as Facebook and LinkedIn, some of these accounts such as Dropbox and Google Docs, personal email accounts have been considered social media by some of the new social media privacy legislation. And so depending on the state, some of these states have really broad definitions of what actual, what constitutes social media under that privacy legislation. So employees can't, I think, just completely focus on employee access to Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, but also have to consider the risk that could be presented by access to personal email accounts or online storage repositories such as Dropbox or Google Docs. And so with the rapidly increase in use in social media, many states have enacted some type of social media privacy legislation. Right now, there's about 23 states that have some type of social media privacy legislation with regards to either access to an employee or a potential candidate's personal social media accounts, or with regards to students or applicants for different schools and universities. And so right now there's about 23 states. The states we have listed either have legislation for both employees and students, or just employees or just students. The most recent was Maine, which earlier this year enacted their social media privacy legislation. We've seen a wealth of other states who either have something pending or something ready to be enacted. And while there are different states who have different language, the kind of breadth and scope of the privacy legislation varies from state to state. They all seem to have some common trends, similarities. One is really focusing on the personal account. So many of these privacy legislations prohibit the employer from requiring or demanding access to the employee's personal email or personal social media account. And that includes not only the direct information and credentials, such as the username and password, but also kind of the indirect access, such as adding employee representatives to those social media accounts or shoulder surfing, in which the employer asks the employee to log in and the employer is kind of over their shoulder watching the screen and seeing the information. And so the legislation is really trying to protect the access to this to personal accounts. Again, what constitutes personal account is going to vary by the language of each state. Another common trend with this legislation is there's no retaliation for the employee invoking their statutory rights. So if the employee or applicant does refuse to provide access, whether it's the direct username and password, or the indirect access, there can be no retaliation. Another protection is for if they're serving as a witness in a litigation or hearing regarding that social media information or evidence. The consequences vary from state to state. We've seen some states who are a little bit more heavy-handed, such as Oregon. They allow lawsuits, penalties, damages, attorney's fees, and as well as some reinstatement and back pay remedies. Other states have been a little bit more light, such as New Jersey. If there is any violations, the employee can make a complaint to the Department of Labor. They may investigate and impose nominal penalties, but again, the keyword is may. With respect to California, it's kind of in the middle right now. There are fines, $1,000 for the first violation and up to $5,000 for subsequent violations. Complaints can't be made to the Labor Department, but as of right now, there's no civil cause of action available. Now, actually, what can the employer do? We've seen, there are restrictions to protect the employees, their privacy, the privacy of their information. But there is still the employer still has some access to the information. There are some exceptions in the legislation. One of them is that the employer still can access non-personal and/or the employer's accounts. Again, as we'll talk later, to what extent the account or the information is non-personal or belongs to the employer can be crafted with different strategies, with different practical mechanisms such as agreements and policies. But the court's going to look at the extent that the account was opened at the employer's request, whether it was used for business, and the employer could have access to that information. With regards to California and many of these states, the legislation does provide an exception for workplace investigations for misconduct or violations. A lot of it is tied to the reasonableness. If there's a reasonable belief that a violation or misappropriation of data theft or other violation has occurred, and a lot of times, to the extent that information can be accessed, is limited solely for the purposes of that investigation. Another area to access is when you have the employer's devices and systems monitoring, which we'll discuss later. When the device or equipment is provided to the employee by the employer, and there are either policies or agreements in place where the employee consents or acknowledges that they don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in certain devices or information. Again, as we'll discuss later, there are some issues when you have the BYOD or where you allow employees to bring their own devices to use for work activities. And again, there are some self-regulatory mechanisms where that can be accessed, for example, applicant screening. And again, for searching for publicly information, could be used and accessed by the employer. Now, we do have this kind of patchwork of different state laws that is on social media privacy legislation. It's still relatively in its infancy, and so the courts are still may likely vary of their interpretation of each state's statutory language. But there are some common themes that courts need to do, and one of them is, what is personal versus the employer account? If an employer can't access the non-personal or the employer accounts and devices, to what extent, what is that? How is it defined? There are some state statutes that actually try to define it. Some don't actually try at all. And there are some issues, too, even if you have a definition in place, to what extent there are those hybrid or BYOD policies where a personal account is on an employer device or vice versa. The other concern is, to what extent can the employer protect their information? There is a balancing between the rights of employees to have the privacy of their information, but also the employer has the right to protect its intellectual property, to protect the value of its confidential and trade secret information, and to what extent the employer can take those efforts to protect that information. Other concerns include, in the context of litigation, is what happens when account content is discovered. If, for example, those social media credentials are discovered through a proper discovery or litigation. And because we have this patchwork of different state laws, there are some issues too with conflict of laws, is of to what extent if you have different employees in different states, and what laws will cover the, each of those employees. So while there are numerous states who've enacted social media legislation and continue, we see more and more states get on board. We've enacted a kind of easy-to-use desktop reference, which is available. We have both digital and a hard copy form. And it discusses each of the different states, kind of breaks down the language, what you can do, what you can't do, what the remedies available. And so it's definitely a helpful guide that we do update with each state that gets on board with new privacy legislation. There is also a state-by-state inquiry for this, so it does specifically tailor to the various states that are on board. Now, while there is some concerns and risks with allowing employees or whether they're not allowed to use social media, there are some concerns with issues both internally and externally when the information is used. Externally, with regards to communications and public relations, there are a lot of companies now who sometimes encourage employees to use social media to participate in campaigns or ongoing, whether it's competitions or sweepstakes or advertising or promoting new products, new services. There are some other existing rules, laws, regulations, and guidelines that have to be taken into consideration. For example, the FTC endorsement guidelines requires a disclosure of material connections. And so when you have an employee who is participating in a campaign to promoting a new product or a new service, if they have a blog, if they have a social media account, there are some requirements that they may need to disclose that they are either an employee or they're receiving a sponsorship or some type of compensation from the employer. With employees also having access to social media, there definitely is the inherent risk that internal information could be disclosed externally. That includes not only confidential or trade secret information, but if there are complaints about the company or in the workplace, that actually could be protected, as we'll discuss later, but also any client rel issues or customer relations issues, or including false information. Internally, when employees have access to social media accounts, you have the potential for discrimination, for harassment, for retaliation against other employees. And there is kind of the concern is with companies creating their IT policies or social media policies to restrict information, restrict the use of social media in the workplace, to what extent, you know, the employees are then taking that activity kind of off-site, but it's still involving employees or other employees or company staff and personnel. So there's definitely an inherent risk in having access to social media. We've seen also there are some legal risks of not regulating social media, so kind of not doing anything at all. With document retention and electronic discovery issues, with litigation, to the extent some of these social media information, communications do have to be preserved, there are some issues that arise to the extent that the employee, that information is covered and that should be protected or preserved. Not regulating social media, you do have the risk of the employee disclosing confidential information and trade secrets. Also with allowing kind of personal devices to be used, but having access to employee accounts, employee databases, kind of the proximity of having the company's information being able to be transferred or accessed on personal devices or accounts is another concern. With regards, there are some securities law concerns. The FINRA regulatory notice that was released in 2010 recognized that there was a growing kind of risk of social media, and to the extent under these security laws, there are requirements that certain communications have to be protected, have to be recorded for record keeping, and you know, to what extent employees' communications? Are they considered third-party communications that are not subject to these record-keeping requirements? There are some concerns, and this is a good notice to kind of describe to the extent some of these documents could be considered attributable to the company and subject to these record-keeping requirements. And some of those key things look at whether the communication was sponsored or endorsed by the company, and whether it involves the company could be attributable to the company. Again, there's other potential legal concerns with potential vicarious liability for discrimination, retaliation, defamation, to the extent that employee is using a social media account illicitly or unlawfully. And here there was a verdict that was over $800,000 for an employee that was harassed based on disability on another employee's blog, in which there was some vicarious liability. Some further legal limits of to what extent social media can be regulated. We'll discuss kind of more in detail regarding the National Labor Relations Act that protects concerted activity and employer communications. And so to the extent employees want to regulate and control the employee social media activity, there is a line and there are some risks of to the extent this information can be it can be regulated. There are whistleblower protections that we've seen increasingly more and more cases come out that are protecting whistleblowers, even in cases where it involves the employer's confidential or protected information. Courts have given some deference and some considerations to protecting those whistleblowers. If any actions are taken against the employee, there is concerns that it could be considered retaliation if it would deter the employee from further communications and be considered an adverse action. There's a wealth of other statutes protecting actual lawful off-duty activities, including other limits on background checking. There are some legal considerations on privacy and other protection concerns. Two cases here are the Stengard versus Loving Care Agency and the Lawler versus North American Corp. In these two cases, we've seen in Lawler, the employer actually hired a private detective to conduct surveillance on an employee because they suspected there was some purported trade secret theft. The private detective in that case for the employer got telephone records of the employee and actually pretended to be her and engaged in surveillance of her home. And even though the employer actually ultimately got, I think it was like $600,000 for the theft of trade secrets, the employee actually got, I think it was $1.8 million for the invasion of her rights to privacy. So there are some concerns and some considerations for conducting these investigations, but also care has to be taken with the privacy rights. In the Steingart case, it was an employee who was using her company laptop to actually access a private personal email account in which she used to exchange communications with her attorney, with her counsel. After she separated from the company, she sued for discrimination, and the employer was actually able to access those attorney-client communications after it imaged her hard drive in discovery. And her attorney's emails did contain a disclaimer that said that they were privileged, and when he did find out that the company had access to them, he demanded the return and sought to kind of exclude it from the lawsuit. The court held that it could be ethical violations, sanctions against the company and the counsel for accessing this information. And specifically, it found that the employee could reasonably expect that email communications with her lawyer through the personal account would remain private, and that even though she sent them through a company laptop, did not necessarily eliminate the attorney-client privilege. There's several cases in different jurisdictions regarding the extent these kind of attorney-client emails or other protected or privileged emails, whether they're still protected when they're sent from employer accounts, employer devices. And so a lot of times it does vary based on the jurisdiction, but also the employer's any agreements, IT policies, and other social media or data access privacy provisions they have in place. Lastly, there's some additional concerns with regulating social media activity. Because it involves communications, there is the inherent risk of violations of freedom of speech, rights of privacy. We've seen two cases in the past regarding unreasonable search and seizures for devices. In regards to the City of Ontario versus Kwan case, it involves the actual pagers. The Ontario Police Department had actually issued these pagers, but while it forbade personal use, the policy actually didn't include pagers, and so the lieutenant in that case advised that personal use was allowed if the employees paid for any overage charges. And in that case, Kwan used a pager to send some illicit text messages to his wife, girlfriend, and a coworker. The lieutenant complained to the chief about the accounting, and it resulted in an audit. And in that case, Kwan actually sued both the city and the wireless provider, and the Ninth Circuit ultimately found that the provider had violated the Stored Communications Act by disclosing these texts, and that the city's informal policy had created a expectation of privacy that was violated by this audit. The Supreme Court, however, reversed, and the court assumed without deciding that he did have expectations of privacy. Again, there was a balancing of the policy versus the supervisor's assurances, but that the search was for a legitimate business purpose and was reasonable, similar to searching a desk in a work area. In regards to the Saban versus Miller case, there was a prison canteen manager who was accused of wrongdoing. She'd used a personal laptop and a personal desktop at her home for government business. When she was accused, the officials confiscated her laptop and drove home with her and then took away her family computer. The court held there was an unreasonable search and seizure, and especially considering it focused on the fact that the device was at her home and her equipment. It was significantly important. And then also finally with anti-SLAPP, there are numerous states that have the ability to bring an anti-SLAPP lawsuit, which is if a lawsuit is brought and depending on the state, if it's to the effect of, you know, chilling any communications that are protected under that state statute, there could be a motion that is brought against the initial plaintiff, and there are different states who allow the potential recovery for not only dismissal but attorney's fees and costs. But again, it varies from state to state and based on the language of that state's anti-SLAPP statute to the extent they actually have one in place. With that, I'll turn it over to Daniel Hart, who's going to talk about some of the specific strategies and practicalities of actually trying to regulate and restrict social media access in the workplace.
Well, thank you, Joshua. And in light of all these limitations, I would like to spend a few minutes on what I hope are some practical pointers on drafting social media policies or agreements. And you can see several bullet points on the screen with provisions that employers should consider including. And first, ideally, the policy or agreement should include some definition of what is proper use. And as part of this, the document should have an acknowledgement by the employee that the company provides employees with internet access, that it is a useful business tool, and that the employees must use it properly. Second, employers might consider including a provision stating that unless the use of social media is directly related to or necessary to perform one's job, employees are not permitted to use social media websites during work hours or while using company-provided equipment and systems. Now, a word of caution is in order here. Last year, the National Labor Relations Board issued a decision in a case called Purple Communications. That the site for that is 361 NLRB, number 126, for anyone interested in that. In a few minutes, we'll talk about another recent NLRB decision, but the background to both Purple Communications and all the other decisions we'll talk about today is Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. As Joshua mentioned, that statute protects employees' rights to engage in concerted activities regarding the terms and conditions of their employment. And in the Purple Communications decision, the NLRB ruled that employees who have access to an employer's email system as part of their job generally may, during non-working time, use the email system to communicate about wages, hours, working conditions, and union issues. And although that case dealt with company email rather than social media sites, the board's reasoning arguably is broad enough to include the use of social media from company computers during non-working time as opposed to working time. In light of this, employers should exercise some caution if they're going to implement rules prohibiting employees from using social media on company computers. If you want to prevent employees from getting on social media sites from company computers because you're concerned about productivity, probably the easiest way to do this is a technical fix rather than a policy fix, and you can simply block a non-work-related social media sites like Facebook from the company's server so that people can't access them from company computers while they're connected to the company's network. A third thing to consider in drafting policies is that the agreement or policy should include some caveats that the company only seeks to regulate social media activity impacting the company. Ideally, the document will include some acknowledgement that social media may be a personal activity, and the company only seeks to regulate it when it impacts the company, coworkers, clients, or third parties who deal with the company, as opposed to generally impacting employees' personal use of social media sites. You know, as an example, the document might advise employees that social media info may become public. The document might warn employees that they should be cognizant of the impression employees create about themselves and the company when they're posting any information regarding the company. And the policy might also inform employees that the company expects them to act responsibly, professionally, and with confidentiality when posting information about the company or its employees. But again, there do need to be some appropriate caveats to ensure that the policy doesn't chill employees' protected activity. And we'll talk more on that in just a minute. Fourth, the policy or agreement ought to include an acknowledgement by the employee that he or she has no expectation of privacy in social media activities that are done at work, on work time, or using company equipment or systems, with the obvious caveat that employers need to abide by all the social media privacy laws that Josh has already discussed. The policy should remind employees that they are expected to follow the company's conduct standards. That would particularly include the policies regarding workplace harassment. The policy should remind employees that they are not to defame anyone or to falsely damage their reputation. But again, as with so many of these other issues, a note of caution really is in order here. As we'll see in a few minutes, comments that disparage the company or management could be protected activities in some circumstances, and so the policy ought to have appropriate caveats that the policy does not prohibit employees from engaging in legally protected activities. The policy should disclose the fact that online activities done at work or on company equipment or systems are subject to monitoring, and it should also expressly disclaim any reasonable expectation of privacy. The policy or agreement should also include a covenant not to disclose confidential information. A note of caution is also in order here. If the term, quote-unquote, confidential information is defined so broadly so as to prevent employees from disclosing information about the terms and conditions of their own employment, the NLRB takes the position that the policy violates Section 7 of the NLRA, which we'll talk about in a minute, and so the policy needs to be drafted to take this into account. And fifth, the policy or agreement ought to include an express acknowledgement about the company's ownership of property and the employee's obligation to return company property. Later in our presentation, Robert will discuss some recent cases addressing the ownership of the content of social media accounts that employees use in connection with their employment. For that reason, if you are requiring employees to create, say, a LinkedIn account or maybe some other account as part of their job duties, the agreement or policy should expressly state that the company has ownership of the content of those accounts, including customer contact information. Inclusion of that kind of language can be very helpful to the employer in being able to demonstrate its ownership right. Now, moving on to the next slide, you see a few more bullet points for consideration. The policy or agreement might prohibit the use of company email addresses for use with social media unless the social media account is directly related to and necessary for the job. And you can also make a distinction among different types of social media accounts. In a lot of workplaces, LinkedIn accounts may be actively used as part of one's job duties. And in that case, an employee might reasonably use their company email address and have that connected to their LinkedIn account. In contrast, an employer might decide that Facebook is a different ballgame altogether. It might not have the same professional benefits to the company, and the company doesn't expect employees to use Facebook in connection with their employment. And in that case, the company can say for these other social media accounts like Facebook, you need to use your own personal email and not connect it to a company email account. Another consideration, the policy or the agreement should inform employees that failure to abide by the guidelines or by the company's conduct standards may subject them to discipline up to and including termination, as well as legal action by the company. The policy or agreement should also be integrated into any other existing policies, for example, IT policies, electronic equipment and systems use policies, any confidentiality policies, the company's code of conduct, and certainly anti-harassment policies. And along the same lines, as already mentioned, the policy or the agreement should address the ownership and return of property. And if the employee has signed a standalone NDA or has an employment agreement with restrictive covenants in there, you'll certainly want to make sure that the social media policy is consistent with whatever other agreements the employee has signed. Now, before moving on, we should pause here to talk in a little more detail about some timely considerations in light of the position that the NLRB has taken. And as I mentioned, and as Joshua mentioned, Section 7 of the NLRA protects employees' rights to engage in concerted activities regarding the terms and conditions of their employment. For that reason, employers cannot enact policies that stifle or prevent employees from engaging in concerted activity for mutual aid and protection. And through a series of decisions over time, the NLRB has developed two major principles here. And the first principle is that employer policies should not be so sweeping that they chill the kinds of activity that are protected by federal labor law, and that could include discussions of wages or working conditions among employees. The second principle is a corollary to it, and that's that an employee's comments on social media are generally not protected if they are mere gripes not made in relation to group activity among employees or working terms and conditions. However, if an employee is engaged in social media activity that's made in relation to group activity and that involves working terms and conditions, then that social media activity is protected under the NLRA. Now, the next slide has some examples of concerted activities that are listed on the screen here. Any sharing of information about wages, complaining about policies or specific managers, displaying support for unions, including union-related insignias or logos, attempting to unionize and organize a union, or otherwise discussing employment terms are all protected by the NLRA. And it's easy to see how all these kinds of activities could be expressed on social media. It could be a Twitter discussion. It could be a post on an employee's personal blog. And it could even be liking somebody else's Facebook post. Now, earlier this year, the General Counsel of the NLRB issued a memorandum directed really at labor lawyers and management that provides some guidance to employers on what's permissible in their policies in light of Section 7 of the NLRA. And some of these are maybe less obvious than others. One observation the General Counsel made is that employers cannot have blanket rules on discussing, quote-unquote, employee information, and this is something that has arisen from several NLRB decisions over the past several years. Now, why does the NLRB take that position? Well, it's because employees have a Section 7 right to discuss wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment with both their fellow employees and with third parties. And so if you have a policy that precludes employees from disclosing, quote unquote, employee information, that by definition is going to prevent them from disclosing information about the wages and the terms and conditions of their employment. And so if the policy is written in that kind of sweeping language, the NLRB takes the position that the policy violates the NLRA. Another interesting observation by the NLRB is that employers' policies cannot require employees to be respectful. Now, that comes as a surprise to many employers, and particularly in the South, where I reside and practice law. But in the gritty world of labor law, I think it's fair to say manners and courtesies often give way to somewhat earthier expressions of protected activity, to say it mildly. Another interesting rule, employers can't prohibit behavior up to, but not quite in subordination. Again, this is a surprise to some employers, but behavior that falls just short of insubordination can be a protected activity in some circumstances. You can't have policies that require refraining from damaging the company reputation or not acting in the company's best interest. This is because, as the NLRB reasons, employees' right to criticize their employer's labor practices include the right to do so in a public forum. NLRB also takes the position that employers cannot prohibit employees from disagreeing with each other, even with strong language. Again, there's a recognition of the fact that salty language often characterizes labor disputes. Employers can't prevent employees from speaking to the media on their own or on other employees' behalf. Although, importantly, employers can stop employees from relaying a quote-unquote company official position. Employers cannot prevent fair use of logos and trademarks, although they can prevent illegal use of logos and trademarks. And employers cannot prevent pictures or videos on all company property. Why is that the case? Because the NLRB reasons, this would be construed as preventing employees from using pictures or cameras to engage in protected activity. Finally, policies cannot prohibit employees from walking off the job as an expression of concerted activity, and I think there's no surprise there since striking is one of the oldest forms of concerted activity recognized by labor law. So these are all things that the NLRB says a social media policy can't prohibit, but what's safe grounds for an employer to have in their policy? Well, at risk of stating the obvious, policies can prohibit employees from engaging in harassing or discriminating behavior, which is going to be a violation of federal and state employment laws. They can prevent employees from disclosing confidential information, again, with the caveat that the definition of confidential information needs to be appropriately tailored. They can prevent employees from making false disparaging remarks about the company. But again, a note of caution is in order here because disparaging remarks can be protected activity as long as they don't rise to the level of defamation. The policies can prevent employees from engaging in violations of trademark and copyright laws as long as they don't prohibit fair use of trademarks. And the policies can prohibit employees from engaging in dishonesty. Now, this brings us to the Triple Play decision, which was just issued last week by the Second Circuit. And this case was an appeal of another notable NLRB decision from last year, and that's the Triple Play Sports Bar and Grill, which is found at 361 NLRB number 31. And the Triple Play decision involved several employees of a sports bar who criticized their company on Facebook. And one employee began a discussion on Facebook complaining about the way that the company treated her tax withholdings. And she wrote, quote, "Maybe someone should do the owners of Triple Play a favor and buy it from them. They can't even do the tax paperwork correctly. Now I owe money, WTF. A second employee then liked the post. And then a discussion ensued in which a third employee added the comment, quote, "I owed too. Such an a-hole," except that he didn't actually say a-hole. He wrote out the phrase. Now, the company fired all the employees who were engaged in this Facebook discussion. And among other things, the company noted that the third employee's comments, as well as some of the other comments, contained profanity, and that this profanity was viewed by customers. Notwithstanding this, the NLRB ruled that these employees engaged in concerted activities protected by Section 7. And the board also held in that case that the employer's internet and blogging policy violated the law. And the policy read, quote, the policy prohibits employees from engaging in inappropriate discussions about the company, management, and or coworkers. And by doing so, the employee may be violating the law and is subject to disciplinary action up to and including termination of employment. The board held that that policy was overly broad, and it violated the NLRA because, read literally, it would prevent employees from exercising their Section 7 rights. And on appeal last week, the Second Circuit affirmed the NLRB's decision, holding that it was not arbitrary and capricious. And so, at least in the states encompassing the Second Circuit, the NLRB's Triple Play decision is now the law of the land. And I think it's probably fair to say that other courts are likely to also affirm those type of decisions when the NLRB enforces its policy in other circuits, although we have yet to see what the other circuits will do if the issue comes to their attention. Now, in light of these considerations, I'll turn the presentation over to Robert to discuss some additional considerations when conducting workplace investigations. But before I do, I have the CLE code for today's presentation. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SS6254. That's SS as in Seyfarth Shaw, 6254. And with that, I'll hand it over to Robert.
Thanks, Dan. In our remaining time, what I hope to accomplish is to discuss some of the investigation and trade secret issues that come up in the social media context, as well as respond to some of the great questions that we've received to date. First, with respect to an investigation, and this is in the context of using social media evidence as part of your workplace investigation. Some key considerations are, when does the investigation begin? And that's important because, as you saw in Josh's discussion, if you're doing a workplace investigation involving employee misconduct, which is an exception to the privacy violation under some of the statutes, the key determination is, did you obtain the social media evidence before the investigation started or after the investigation started? And as a result, was there a violation because the sort of the fruit of the poisonous tree, you already obtained the evidence as a privacy violation? So that's a key determination. And then what evidence can be considered and relied upon? If it's been tainted, do you still want to use that evidence as part of your discipline decision? Or have you been able to independently derive that evidence through witness interviews or through other sources such as employee consent to obtain the social media evidence? Some of the other key considerations when evaluating the social media evidence, and this can go for as far as the device or the account itself, is who owns the device or account? Is it the company or the employee? And can the employee, can the company search the device or account? Has there been employee consent as through a written policy or agreement? What was the employee's reasonable expectation of privacy? Was that laid out in the employee handbook? Did the employee consent during the interview? And did the employee sign the social media IT policy? Was there some sort of acknowledgement in the file that you could use later if the employee says that if this was done without their consent and violated their privacy rights? And then as far as if you're searching the account or the device, what's the scope of your search going to be? Can you use newly discovered information, be it passwords or additional posts that may be, you know, that may be informing the investigation and that may help support the investigation? And then based upon what you determined in your workplace investigation and using that social media evidence, what's the extent of the disciplinary action that you're gonna take? Now, in the context of social media and trade secrets, I think it's important because there's often a sense that social media is different, certainly employees sometimes have the impression that they have a different persona or different obligations as it relates to social media, but certainly that's not the case. The same non-disclosure confidentiality restrictions that apply in the workplace outside of social media apply in social media. So if you were not allowed to disclose the latest, greatest product that's going to hit the market in, 20 days to your friends and colleagues, that applies to social media as opposed to just telling them in person or telling a competitor in a job interview. But the key thing in order to establish the trade secret, and as you can see the elements on the screen, is the efforts to maintain secrecy. And that's why the agreements and policies that employers have with employees are key, but also part of that and go hand in hand in that is making sure you have significant employee training so that they understand the do's and don'ts and understand practical examples so that they know what the rules of the road are. And in the social media context, oftentimes there's issues about disclosure of information on social media and what we can and can we still maintain a trade secret. And the other issue as it relates to social media is can we store information that we believe is confidential and trade secret information in social media databases and it still be considered a trade secret? And these six factors that you see on the screen as far as whether information can constitute a trade secret, you can see that it does not rule out that you can still maintain the social media the status of information that's stored in social media platforms as a trade secret because these six factors obviously are not going to rule out that per se that they can't be trade secret just because they're stored in the cloud or they're stored in LinkedIn or whatnot. But there needs to be careful consideration about the preferences and settings within those social media accounts. And if the company is not thoughtful about what those settings and preferences are, then you're exposing yourself to the arguments that reasonable measures were not taken to maintain the trade secrecy. And also on the factor of time, effort, and money expended in the development in creating the customer list that you want to consider to be a trade secret, if that information is easily available on the internet, if you're able to reverse engineer that through Google searches, through LinkedIn searches, that's going to undercut the argument that your customer list is a trade secret. This next slide about who's stealing the data. Employees are a real threat to the theft of confidential information of the companies, and this is really significant in the sense that through social media, there's an encouragement of sharing information and generating revenues or generating more and more communications about the exchange of information, and it's somewhat antithetical to the whole notion of a trade secret, which is secrecy. That coupled with technology and the proliferation of online storage and mobile devices, it can be a real perfect storm. And that's why companies really need to be thoughtful about what agreements, policies they have in place, and what type of, you know, computing resources they make available to their employees, whether they have a bring your own device policy or they have company owned equipment, and what type of monitoring that they have on that type of equipment. Some of the significant cases, and obviously Dan dealt with one of our hypotheticals in his discussion, but I wanted to go on some of the other hypotheticals that I teased at the beginning of the presentation. These are, there's three cases that have been significant as far as whether there can be a customer list protection for contact information that's stored in social media platforms. Three different cases, SaskLaw Group, PhoneDog, and Christo. In the LinkedIn, as you can see on the slide, courts have differed as far as whether you can, that type of contact information can qualify as a trade secret if stored in a social media platform. In the SaskLaw Group case, what's significant there is that the defendant was able to show that they were, though she admitted that she did take customer list information, she was able to show that that information was not valuable because she was able to reverse engineer the information through Google searches, LinkedIn searches. And so in that particular instance, the court wasn't willing to protect that information as a trade secret. In contrast, in the PhoneDog and Christo cases, the platforms involved were Twitter and MySpace, the Twitter followers and the MySpace connections. And in those particular court cases, the court was willing to allow the trade secret case to go beyond the pleading stage because there was a colorable argument that there could be independent economic value in those followers and connections. And at least at the pleading stage, it wasn't dispositive that just because they were on a social media platform that there hadn't been reasonable secrecy measures. Another significant issue, particularly if you're in the business of providing content to your customers, is, well, who owns the social media account? And is that significant in your business? And the key takeaway there is you need to have an agreement with your employee about who owns a particular social media account, whether it's a LinkedIn account, a Twitter account, an online storage account. Particularly companies that are trying to save money and may not have enough cloud resources, do they allow their employees to have Dropbox accounts? And who owns that Dropbox account if they leave? And have you documented a policy and agreement as it relates to that particular account? Now, in these three cases, again, the courts were across the map as far as how they came out. In the PhoneDog Kravitz case, there was no agreement between the employee and the employer about who owned the account. In that particular case, that was one of our examples. It was a mobile communications content company that gave reviews of new online devices, and the employee made a claim that he owned the account and that his followers were worth $2.50 per follower, and he had a significant number of followers. Where the case ultimately settled with the employee obtaining ownership of the Twitter account. What the employer could have done there if they were so concerned about the Twitter account is they could have had an agreement and policy with the employee to secure ownership. And since that particular business in the content business, that was near and dear to their company, it behooved them to have such a policy and agreement. In the Eagle versus Morgan case, again, there was not a clear policy that made it definitive that the employee didn't have an interest in the account. And in that case, there was a significant amount of legal fees. It actually went to trial, and it was essentially a case where there was no clear winner. There was no exchange of any sort of large compensation. And the learning lesson there was make sure you have an agreement about the social media account. And then a successful case for the employer was the Artist Health case, where there was an ownership agreement regarding the social media account, and the employee refused to return the account, and the employer was able to get an injunction requiring the return of the account to the employer. Some significant cases as it relates to restrictive covenants in social media. I think what I said earlier as far as you may not have the best case trying to protect connections and customer lists that are housed in social media platforms, I think that's a good rule of thumb. It's a more challenging case. But certainly if you're trying to sue for a violation of a non-compete or a restrictive covenant or for the disclosure of confidential information, social media is a wealth of evidence, whether it's notifying, connections that you've left the job, whether you are reaching out to connections about you, about them having them join your new company. It can be a wealth of evidence to help support claims. Now, these two cases on your screen, in those particular cases, the enhanced network case, there was a public LinkedIn job posting, and that was an agreement between two companies that they were using, that one of the companies was using the employees as contractors on an assignment, and they were essentially trying to cut out the middleman, and they had advertised for LinkedIn job postings on their public LinkedIn page. In that particular case, the court didn't find a violation of the non-solicitive employee provisions because it was just part of their ordinary business, their business model, and they weren't specifically reaching out to the employees. They were just generally advertising for job positions. And in the other case, the prepaid legal services versus Cahill case, the court found that just general Twitter invites and Facebook posts about the new employer that were not specifically targeted to the employees, albeit the particular employees were friends and followers of the employee that got sued, the court found that that wasn't a per se violation of the non-solicitation agreement. But you can see that it can be compelling evidence, and it can be just the tip of the iceberg, because where there's social media posts and announcements, there's likely to be follow-up communications either by email or telephone. And then lastly, Dan got into sort of the do's and don'ts as it relates to social media policies. We've had a number of questions about examples and model policies. The answer to that is that to do it correctly, you really need to have a custom policy that takes into account your particular business, what type of a business environment that you want to create, whether you're a very sort of black and white and legalistic type policy, or you want one where there's more education about do's and don'ts for employees and incorporating that into the employee education process. Now, certainly on the web, a number of companies have posted their social media policies. I believe there's a collection of over 150 policies at one particular website. And so that can be a starting point, but the way to do it correctly is really to develop your own policy that deals with your relationships with your employees and how you conduct business. Things that you want to take into account in creating that policy is the definition of personal versus non-personal account, the scope of employer investigations involving mandatory access to employees' accounts, how you want to formulate that. How you want to go about defining confidential information in the social media policy and providing specific examples of what you consider to be confidential information. One thing I wanted to leave you with is another one of our hypos. Social media is a tremendous headache for a number of employers, particularly when it comes in the litigation context. And yes, social media, text messages are all covered under ESI in civil litigation in state as well as federal court. And one particular horror story was an employee who had brought a personal injury lawsuit, and at deposition it was made clear that the employee had posted unflattering information about their activities in that social media account. Later was informed by his attorney to destroy the account, and he followed the instructions. and the court issued a sanction, sanctioned the attorney for over $520,000 and sanctioned the employee for $180,000 for destroying that social media account. So I think it highlights that social media is not going anywhere, that it does contain sort of relevant evidence, and sort of the head in the cloud approach is not going to work. Social media is not going anywhere. The social media privacy laws are not going anywhere, and so employers need to take note of those laws, understand those laws, and we hope that social media privacy desktop reference is a good guide. Because if you're in one of those 20 states that have adopted, the social media privacy legislation, you really need to consult those to see what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, if you're going to be using social media evidence in your investigation or in your litigation. With that, I wanted to answer a few questions. First, Dan, we had a question with respect to limiting the use of cell phones and smartphones while working. What are your thoughts on that? This particular client works in the hotel industry, and they want to know whether they can restrict the use of cell phones and smartphones in the workplace.
Right. In general, a restriction on employees' use of any type of media for personal use during work hours would not be a per se violation of the NLRA, and actually would be, in a lot of cases, a prudent rule on ensuring employees are being productive. The problem would be if there's distinctions being made based on the type of activity, and so employees can engage in personal phone calls but not engage in phone calls with union reps. That would be a problem.
And then we had a question about what's the name of the case where the attorney and the client was sanctioned for destroying their social media account. That's the famous I Heart Moms, or I Love I Heart Hot Moms case, and we can get you the evidence citation for that. We'll send you an email on that. Any other questions? We have a question here about, it's a good observation. My experience has shown that there's two general camps when it comes to employee use of social media in the workplace. One is the application of legalistic restrictions around such use, and the other is simply providing guardrails to enable appropriate use of social media. Which are you seeing most in your travels? What are your thoughts on that, Dan?
Well, I think they really run the gamut. And again, as Robert mentioned, it's important to have a policy that it matches a particular company's own business, and some companies prefer to have a more generic policy and others a more legalistic policy. I don't know if there's any right or wrong answer, and I don't know that I'm seeing, in my experience, one type versus the other type. I think it really depends on what the company is trying to achieve and what its goals are, what its business needs are.
Yeah, I think that there's certain bells and whistles as far as the legalistic formulation of the policy that you need to have. But in order for that policy to really work, it needs to be the employees need to be invested in the policy, and so they really need to have that training and those examples so that they understand what the policy is and why it's important. But as a backdrop, legal and HR need to have a legally sound policy so that if they need to enforce it, they can use it to our advantage. Another quick question we had is, picture taking is a concern. We have proprietary equipment and processes that we don't want to be shared. Any thoughts about how that would impact the social media policy?
Right. So certainly it would be appropriate to have restrictions on employees disclosing proprietary information through photography or any other type of media. What the NLRB's concern is that if the policy, even if it's intended to limit only that type of behavior, is written so broadly that it could prohibit employees from having any kind of pictures in the workplace, that's where the problem arises. And as with so many areas here with the NLRB's guidance, it really comes down to how broadly policies are drafted.
Right, and I think, as we indicated, you know, customization and specialization is the key, because it really means that you understand your business, and so you can use another company's policy as a template, but you really need to customize it for your own your own company. So with that, we'd like to thank you for your time and for joining us on today's webinar. If you want to stay current on some of the social media and privacy issues, we invite you to take a look at our two blogs, tradesecretslaw.com and globalprivacywatch.com. Our next webinar is going to be on November 19th, and that will be the final webinar of this year for the Trade Secret Privacy Social Media Group. It's going to be on non-compete and restricted covenant agreements in the franchise context. So be lookout for an invitation for that particular webinar, and you can also always sign up on our Trade Secret blog as well. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll be providing you a thank you email for those who attended with the presentation materials, as well as some of the case citations that you've asked for.
Thank you, and this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.